Fantastic. Good morning. I'm Cal, grateful alcoholic. And this meeting is significant. First of all, thank you so much, Jim, for asking me to speak. I find myself less nervous than usual, but still nervous, which reminds me that I'm still human. I was hoping there would be a new person that I can speak to on the meeting, but hopefully this is a bit more than entertainment. Hopefully this is a bit more me sharing my truth, and maybe I'll get to make friends with some of you. Hopefully something I say is useful to you. It's still early morning here on Sunday, and I started going to a different meeting that early in the morning, which is why I've not been at this meeting. But I'm grateful for Kirk to introduce me to this meeting. And then through some of my shares in this meeting, I got to be introduced to South Dixie online virtual meeting. And South Dixie is now my home group where I attend daily. And that has led me to a beautiful fellowship and a sponsor that I've been working with. So I'm very, very grateful. I owe my life, or so much of the transformation, so much of the change, and so much the good things about my life that I currently experience and have experienced over the years has been in context of having been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I owe it a debt of gratitude and I guess showing up to a meeting is a part of that experience. Another commitment that I have is Tuesday night, I take in a meeting to a rehab halfway house here in West Hollywood with another AA buddy. And that has been just such a great reminder. Getting to see what it looks like when you're coming off the street. I myself was also at a rehab years ago. So I'll speak a little bit about my life and hopefully we'll get current. I do want to leave some time that. So I can hear from you. A lot of you have a lot more time than me and a lot more experience to share with me. So hopefully I'll get to hear that as well. I had a very strange life, and I'm quite certain each one of you would say that. But I grew up in New York, an hour north of Manhattan in 18th century Europe. And that's kind of what it felt like. So I grew up in New York, practically. An American city. But where I grew up would look more like an Amish town than anything else. Men and women walking two different sides of the street. I did not grow up speaking English. English is practically my third language. I grew up speaking Yiddish and Hebrew. And a very unique situation where I come from a very large family. I'm one of 12. My grandmother, who's currently still alive, who is a survivor, Holocaust survivor. She is 97 and about a year ago had over 1,000 offsprings who are still alive in the town that I grew up in. So I come from a very large family. Two of my aunts have 18 kids. They are all super devout, Jewish, Orthodox, Yiddish speaking individuals. There's no television, there's no smartphones. The way people dress, the way people conduct their lives, the way people, everything. It's almost like living at a monastery. It's the closest that I can relate it after, having been around the world. It's a very much of a monastic life. What they dress, how they dress, what they eat, when they eat, the intention around eating, how they conduct themselves. Like I grew up in a world where when a parent walks into the room, you would usually stand up and then sit down with them. Every aspect of life has a particular demeanor. Every aspect of life has rules to follow. So my childhood, when I go back as far as I can remember, was very safe and very, I have a lot of warm feelings of my life growing up when my father would go to the synagogue Friday night on the Sabbath. Me and my siblings would sit on the couch with my mother and we would sing around the lit candles. And there was something about it that was comforting. And when I was young enough, yeah, it's a lot of fond memories to look back to. But as I grew up and I needed to start complying to my environment, and I needed to dress differently, and I needed not to be around girls, and I needed to start obeying and practicing what was expected of me, something about it didn't feel right. And there was almost like my inner world and how I've viewed myself and how I conducted myself, and my inner thoughts just didn't match the world around me. And I think that's where the earliest that I can trace back to what alcoholism looked like, that I would always look out into the world and watch people go about with ease and compliance and like a sense of like, oh, this is what everyone does, I will do that too. And that never made sense to me. If everyone was going right, I wanted to go left. If the crowd was doing one thing, I wanted to be somewhere else. And that I've never understood. That's kind of like part of my makeup was I was building an inner world that slowly started going toward, I don't understand why you're making me do X, Y, and Z. Why would the rules apply to me? It just never made sense. And I think my, not I think, I'm very certain, my first escape was an internal escapism. It was toward over-sexualization of the world around me, removing myself from the world. So when I took my first drink, I want to say I was around 10 or 11 years old. I can't remember the exact age, but it was around the Jewish holiday. Don't ask me why, but maybe if you're an alcoholic and you're here too, this might make sense to you. But my first remembrance of a drink was it was cold, dark in our basement where I'd hid some alcohol so I can get ahead of the festivities of that particular Jewish holiday. I would assume I did that because doing that in my living room or in my home wouldn't have been accepted. And I remember taking that first drink and the noise stopped. The confusion stopped for just a moment. The wanting to the crawl out of my skin, feeling so different, stopped for a little bit. And for the first couple of years, did I start drinking all the time? No. But in the Jewish world, especially in my home, someone was always born and someone was always passing and someone was always getting married and someone was always having bar mitzvah and someone was always, there was always a festivity. So I was the kid that would run around the table and drink the rest of the wine or the vodka that they would drink, etc. So I had a very clear recollection of what alcohol felt. It made me feel that I can relax, made me feel at ease, and that was a significant feeling. Now my life took a very strange turn. I don't really know why. Perhaps after 120, or perhaps when I meet my maker, my life looking back will make a bit more sense. But feeling different, not feeling loved, not feeling a part of, I started gravitating toward the outside strange world. Sexual abuse, which I didn't call it abuse for many, many years until my early 20s, but me being introduced to things that children should not be introduced. I got a really good dose of watching hypocrisy and corruption and power and money and sexuality get mixed in ways that children shouldn't be introduced to. And that just added to the discomfort. That just added to me feeling different and kind of looking at the world that I grew up in as, oh, what's being presented in the outside world isn't necessarily what is actually congruent. Like what they're preaching isn't actually how they're living their lives, because I get to see behind closed doors when I'm handed money, when sexual exchanges are exchanged with people that shouldn't be happening. And for a very long time, the reason why I didn't call it abuse, because it didn't feel like abuse. It was the places where I found acceptance. It's the place where I found relevance. It's the place where I got unconditional love or conditional love, but it's the place where I was paid attention, where at home that wasn't happening. So life got really, really complicated. I eventually was sent away from that community at a very young age. Drugs and alcohol through my teens became more of a common thing, especially when I was not home. So by the time between age 12 and 18, by the time I arrived at 16, 17, and 18, there was not a fiber of my being that believed that I was going to make it past 21. I was high and drunk all the time. I was sent to Israel for a little while, where I was dealing drugs, and eventually had to escape Israel. Like quite literally, they had to get me out really quickly because the cops were after me because a friend had died. So the living on the streets, meeting people that I should not be interacting with, became a normal thing, and survival was on. Becoming a chameleon, being able to know the right thing, smile at the right time, sound really good, present in a particular way where I will buy your affection, became a part of my makeup. Like my life at home, my life at this religious cult community, quote unquote. And then through my teens, survival became this instinctual thing. And I did it really well. And never really pausing for a moment, never really having the ability to contemplate and meditate what was going on around in my life. So here I am. I had left Israel. I had people that knew the authorities that were able to get me out to make sure that I wasn't on any particular list. I arrived back in Brooklyn and life got a lot worse. I had an apartment on Ocean Parkway between Ann and O and Flatbush, New York. And it was like the party house, bunch of young kids partying there every day. I weekends, weekdays, none of it made any, there was no change. I remember very distinctly, I tried not to be out in the streets early in the morning, but I quite distinctly can remember once watching people go to work one particular morning. Maybe it was a Monday morning, maybe it was a Friday morning. Not really sure if it was the beginning or the end of the week. But I remember looking at, like, wow, how depressing. Like, these people have these boring ass lives. They're like this monotonous, redundant, like, it's a particular time and they're going to do their thing. I just remember looking at, I literally remember having this disdain in my soul, like looking at this, wow, I hope I never live that life. Like, how boring that is. My life was strobe lights and loud techno music and a bunch of drugs and a bunch of cute girls. And, like, we were going 100 miles an hour towards impending doom. I quite distinctly remember I had a young friend who was 16 years old. One day she stopped coming around the apartment. What had happened? She was in a car in Ocean Park on Coney Island on the boardwalk with another guy late at night, and she had never driven a car. Instead of going forward, they went backwards and they drowned. And now she was in a coma. Like, these had another friend who I knew was going to rehab in California, where I've never been, that far land away. He'd come back from rehab and walked into the subway and committed suicide and had his body all over the wall. Like, these things became kind of normal. I didn't expect to grow up. I didn't expect to become an adult. I didn't expect to see what life had to offer. I was rageful. I was angry. I felt misunderstood. And when I would think of the people that violated me, all I can think of is putting a gun up their ass and having my way. Like, it wasn't like there wasn't like beautiful roses or aspirations for a future up to that point. On February 28th, 2001, one of the days of my life that changed everything for me I was in my apartment and doing what I was doing every night before. The same amount of drugs, the same type of drugs, the same fake smiles on my face, the same let me entertain the world and gangsters will come in and have to break up fights, and different people would bring strangers to my apartment and not know who was who, and would come back from a run and the girlfriend had invited seven other people and kind of feel strange in my own apartment, and a life of delusion and insanity. And all of a sudden, something in the pit of my stomach felt like it was ripping itself out. And it was a sensation I've never felt before. I couldn't explain it till today. And the pain became physically so excruciating and so disorienting that it sobered me up from the slumber that I was in on a lot of drugs. And I went into my bathroom, put a bunch of water on my face, looked in the mirror, couldn't really explain what was happening. And I ran outside. It was February in New York, a few feet of snow in New York, in Brooklyn. I run through the snow onto Ocean Parkway, where there's a bunch of benches, fell on my knees, and for the first time in my life, watched my mind. There's a few distinct things that happened that night that took me a couple years to understand, but it was the first time where I wasn't my mind. It was the first time where I wasn't my thoughts. It was the first time where the noise that was happening internally wasn't me. It was like something I was watching. I have no idea how long I was on my knees. I have no idea how long I was on the floor. I have no, it might have been a minute, a second, an hour. No context, because everyone else didn't particularly care or check on me. What had happened that night had me walk away with the thought, don't tell anybody what just happened, because they're going to talk you out of it. And what just happened was really significant. It was the first time in my life where I didn't want to die. It was the first time in my life where I had a sense of what is about to unfold is going to be really significant. Pay attention to it. These were not conclusions I could have come to. I was heading toward the moving train. I wasn't heading toward, let's figure out what the potentialities of life could hold. From that experience, a few different things happened over the next few weeks afterwards that I was very certain were very connected. I found myself in Cape Cod on the water, high off of my mind, looking at the ocean, weeping, knowing that on the other side of this ocean, something was going to transpire. I had no idea where I was looking, what was happening. And on that particular night, I had surrendered. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. Like, this life isn't something I could continue. I just can't. And the person that I was with, a friend of mine, introduced me to somebody else. A few different things happened. I ended up going to a psych ward in Queens and then was sent to Arms Acres for rehab upstate New York. When I checked into the psych ward, they took a bunch of cocaine off of me, a knife, brass knuckles. Like, I wasn't a very sweet kid. I was just a terrified, mortified, violent, lone child that was just pretending to be an adult. And I then discovered that a few days after checking in, the cops were at my apartment. SWAT was there. How that happened, how it missed, well, I would later discover Howard Graves and myself was starting to intervene in my life. But that experience on Ocean Parkway was truly the best way I like to describe it to myself was like being brought to my knees in hell to the gates of heaven. Like, something happened that I didn't choose, didn't contemplate, didn't read any books. Something had transpired where I was called to something else. Rehab and the psych ward was for me kind of like living at a monastery. I was surrounded by gangsters. I quite literally, like, I was one of the only white kids at rehab. They laughed and made fun of me all the time, but and I would listen to stories of different gangs, different drug dealers, and for some strange reason, like what they shared and how they shared and their struggle felt like mine, although like our backgrounds were nothing alike. I can write an entire book of my experiences being in rehab. Like there was like constantly epiphanies, but every morning we would sit in the meditation room in the basement where the lights were dimmed and the music would play, and I just had my face between my legs, just weeping every morning. And between the songs and the music and being sober for the first time, driving from psych ward to the rehab, I remember just like being glued to the window outside and just constantly being like, and the drive of thought, I was losing my mind. I just have not seen the colors for so long that it was just like these new experiences. The psych ward, as well as the rehab, it was the constant happenings. It was like rehab. There was meetings and therapy and groups and like looking for the cute girls and going to get my medications and doing intense work and then having this like pattern, this discipline. But what I would distinctly remember, there were certain nights where these people with nicely dressed suits and their Starbucks coffee will come and will sit at a meeting. Like I didn't know what they were. Like I don't remember. It was my brain was just coming online, so I didn't really know where they were from. But I just have this distinct memory that they were dressed well, they were well mannered, and what they shared felt intoxicating. I was looking forward to seeing that. I was looking forward to feeling what I was feeling like when they were in the room. Like I just didn't know what it was. After rehab, my therapist or the counselor at the time was like, "It wouldn't make sense for you to go back to Brooklyn. Like your parents are not necessarily there. Why go back to where you were running with the people that I was running with?" And they recommended that I go to Florida to a halfway house. Now, I was looking at the brochure of Florida. I guess the marketing department of whoever created that brochure was very, very intentional, but I kind of thought I was going on vacation. I thought I was going to Florida where there's beaches and pina coladas and bikinis, and it's gonna be a great place to go. Now, I arrive in Florida. It's insanely hot. It's pouring rain season. I arrive at midnight. I get picked up and I get driven to where I thought I was going to be coming to a resort. And I show up in Lantana, Florida at this small little house. I get shown to my bed by the counselor. And if I was going to sit up on the bed, I would like hit the fan that was above my bed. It was nothing like what I anticipated. There was nothing that, I was looking forward to. And I had one of those moments that I've never had before because I've not been sober for very long, where I kind of blacked out and I came to a few blocks away from the halfway house with my luggage in hand, with no cell phone, didn't have a cell phone at the time, with no money, no clarity where I was heading. I just came to. There came another moment. I heard, "Al, who said it's going to be any different this time?" I dropped my luggage. I literally pinched myself and tried to see if there was somebody behind me. And I watched the conversation happen. "Who said it's going to be any different this time?" And the response was, "I don't actually know." And then I kind of, oh, from girlfriend to girlfriend, from drug to drug, from city to city, from one survival strategy to next survival strategy, and I witnessed this conversation. Something I've never encountered up to that point. And the conclusion was, go back and find out. If you stopped running, perhaps you're going to have a new experience. The next day, I came back, went to sleep. The next day, I got oriented into the halfway house. And I was taken to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sober enough. I'm sane enough. I'm adult enough that I was told it was an AA meeting. And now I can, oh, that thing, the people that came to the halfway house, to the psych ward, the people that came to the rehab, oh, they were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They brought a meeting in there. That started clicking. And thank God, quite literally, that the meeting that I went to was it was a big book focused meeting. It was at a church. Because I identified as a new person, they a few people came up to me, like, thank God they didn't be like, well, keep coming back and figure out for yourself what AA is and take your time. And I owe my life to the people that were at that particular meeting who, like, they handed me a book. And for a moment, I thought, oh, how kind of this person, like, they're giving me a gift. And within seconds, before I can finish that particular thought, he was like, no, this is not a gift. You're going to get a job at some point and you're going to start making money. And you're going to bring that money and pay the meeting back. And I was handed a book, and then I was introduced to this guy, Sky, who was going to become my sponsor, who told me, call me tomorrow morning exactly at 7 o'clock, not a minute before, not a minute after. And so I did. I ran out in the pouring rain in Florida and ran to the payphone, put in a quarter, called him up, and did what I've done my entire life, pretended like everything was good. And with this fake pitch, high pitch voice, I went, hi, Sky, what's going on? And his response was, none of your damn business. What's going on with you? It wasn't going to be a friendship. It wasn't going to be a like, we're going to chit chat and I'm going to tell you about my day. That's not what that relationship was. And I proceeded for the months to come. I would go to that meeting. Sometimes he would pick me up. Other people would pick me up. I got to see, like, an altruistic love that I've never experienced before. Strangers would come, pick me up, take me to meetings. And I remember sitting in his car and watch how he interacted with his girlfriend. And like, my brain was melting. I just couldn't even believe what I saw. They were kind to each other. They were playful. They were curious about each other. I just remember looking with amazement. It was almost like I was mentally taking notes. Like, these people were sane. Like, I didn't even know how they did that. And I've showed up to meeting to that my home group. And I remember looking around how comfortable people were in their skin. I just couldn't make sense of it. Now, it's a very I want to read something in the big book, and it's on page 12 in Bill's story. I'm sure many of you would know the reference, but Bill goes, thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed, scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors. And the reason why I'm reading that is not so much to show you I know the big book, but because I recently attended a big book study where someone who has decades of experience pointed something out that after years of being in Alcoholics Anonymous, I went, oh, that's something I didn't know. Now, he's writing this experience much later in his story. But what this guy had pointed out, that this paragraph is actually a reference to before Bill W. went off to war, when he was at the cathedral, the ominous warning, he had a spiritual awakening before he took his first drink, before he went to Wall Street, before any of the story that we know of Bill Wilson, of him hitting bottom, going to hospital multiple times, encountering Doc, Silkworth. Like, he had this moment where he was going to war and he was going to die, and he had an awakening. And the reason why I'm saying that is that February 28th, 2001, when I had this grace show up in my life, that wasn't the end of it. Like, for some reason, my experience with God, the power greater than myself, transforming or opening the door or reminding, hey, who said it's going to be any different this time? All that was an opening of a potential. All that was an opening of a door. That doesn't mean that I will forever be changed and never have to come back to that humility. Now, worldly clamors actually happened. The distractions, the oh wow, pretty people, gorgeous women, money, pursued. I stayed sober for 6 years after that experience. I went from Lantana, Florida, to west to South Beach. South Beach, if you ever been in South Beach, you get the reference of a bunch of clubs and So the first time I'm an adult and I'm pursuing things. Like, am I still going to meetings? Yes. Am I still doing the rituals? Yes. But I get distracted. I got distracted. I forgot. I didn't really know who called me, so I didn't really respond to that call. Life became very interesting. I started attending church with other members of AA. I remember sitting Sunday mornings at church, weeping, hearing the music, literally and internally. And then some really interesting and strange things happened, which is less for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but there was a whole intervention. My Jewish community discovered or heard from me sharing with another person of my experience of what was happening. I'm going to AA and I'm working the steps and life is becoming better and I'm going to church. And for some reason, there was an intervention and I found myself sent or given the opportunity to go to Israel to look at Judaism. Like, there were people that were highly invested to save my soul so I don't continue the life that I was pursuing or that the trajectory that I was on. And I found myself going to Israel, study Judaism in a new way, differently than how I grew up, a place where I can ask questions. And such me being, I guess me getting in the way of myself, the ego coming back, and then being sober, I was being sober from drugs and alcohol. Me pursuing all other distractions for some reason continued. The same fantasy, the same escape from being a kid, from how I grew up, misconduct or out of integrity around sexuality, around money, around just living life on life's terms. I was not good at that. I stayed sober for 6 years, got married in Israel, got divorced, left Israel to move to Pittsburgh, PA. Went from Pittsburgh to Texas, from Texas to San Francisco. Lots is happening in my life. And after some time arriving in San Francisco, I was like, I'm not really sure if Alcoholics Anonymous is really for me. I had a sponsor at the time. And I came to my sponsor and I went, I don't really know if I'm a real alcoholic or not. I don't know if I drank the way I drank because the life that I had, the abuse that I went through, or not really knowing how to cope. And perhaps alcohol was a great escape, but I don't really know if I had this thing. And I'm grateful what he said was like, I guess you're going to go find out. Can't really diagnose you. Can't really tell you if you're an alcoholic or not. So I went to find out. On my birthday one day with my girlfriend at the time, we went out for dinner and I had a glass of wine. And I wasn't struck. There was no lightning that had me collapse. Like the sky didn't open. The wine tasted like wine. And for a very long time, I kind of felt that it's a strange thing to say, but it felt like I had enough God in me that alcohol didn't affect me the way it did for a while. It's like I was still doing my meditation, but drinking sometime. I was still doing the right thing. But, and then that took me around 10 years where life got really dark towards that 10 years. The company that I was running, the parties that I was hosting, the cocaine that I was putting up my nose, the insane amount. Like I got to a point where, towards the end, being rushed to the hospital, being convinced I'm dying, saying my goodbyes, and after all kinds of tests, the therapist or the nurse or the interventionist at the ER would come in or came in and handed me pamphlets of AA and NA. And I remember like, oh, it's been quite a few years since anyone has reminded me that Alcoholics Anonymous existed. Like it didn't even occur. Like it wasn't like it just AA was one of those things that I'd once did, although that was like 6 years of my life. And I went straight from the ER to the Four Seasons where to have another martini or go to another fashion event. Yeah, life got really strange. My 30th birthday was hosted by friends at a hotel with like, I remember my friend showing up with an entire suitcase full of drugs, and it was like a few day just sexapade, and life got really strange. I went from San Francisco to LA and launched another company that a moral human should not run, should not launch. And I needed money, so I started dealing drugs. Like, it was very strange, like here being in my early 30s and living this completely disconnected, flying between LA and New York and San Francisco monthly, bringing back obscene amount of cash to the West Coast, coming back to New York, picking up a bunch of drugs, distributing in different places. You're like, the strange thing of the alcoholic's life is I have you think one thing, but my internal world is this miserable lie that I make sure that you don't see. At least that's how I lived. And the girlfriend at the time who I was living with and dating, who was like, she got to the point she wanted to throw my stuff out of the window. Like, she's just like, get out of my life. And for some reason that seemed like a suggestion, and a suggestion that I didn't really care to take. So I continued my life. In the book, he talks about this flimsy reed that experience that seemed like a flimsy reed that was the loving hand of our God. December 28th, 26th, 28th. I moved it to 28th because of it was a holiday that year. 2016. I was in my kitchen one morning, and the voice came back, and it was in the form of a thought that went, "You can go home to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I was stunned. This has been a while since I've had that emotion or that experience where I was being called back home. Now, you would think I've had profound experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I should know that's a place where people will be kind and loving toward me, but that knowledge did nothing for me. I did a 10-year run. In that 10-year, had another child, started a few more projects, abandoned a few more projects, came friends with a bunch of people, neglected a bunch of people, used a bunch of people, put myself in all kinds of insanity. Not once did it occur to me, even when the girlfriend was screaming, "Go get help, you're insane, stop using me, get out of my life," did it ever occur to me that I can go back to alcoholics? No, it wasn't an option. It just didn't occur to me, which is why I know those who arrive in AA are chosen to be in AA. More alcoholics like us don't end up having this particular opportunity. On that particular morning, the thought came, you can go back home to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did. And I came back like a newcomer, and started going to meetings, got a sponsor, went through the steps again. Life started getting a bit more sane. Now, that's all my through my 30s. I'm going to skip. I can't believe it's actually 7:52. I've never actually shared my entire experience from growing up till this particular. And the reason why I could share this particular way, because I recently wrote this down in notes with my new sponsor. He's like, "I want to get to know you, write down a little bit what your history was." So it's a bit more present. And so I have now a bit over 8 years. In the last few, I'll speak a little bit more to the last year. I'm going to meetings. I come back from New York after COVID. I was in New York for a little bit. Engagement. I got engaged to this girlfriend. We ended our engagement. I'm in New York. I'm reconnecting with my family for religious reasons or being curious about a little more about the Jewish community here in LA. I came to LA. But I'm going to meetings and just things don't feel right. I'm looking, where's this glimpse where people, So cheesy, but it could not be more true. I was looking for, like, where's the message of the language of the heart? Where's that sparkle in people's eyes? And I'd be like, people go to meetings and they're like, they're talking about things, but it's like all noise. I would leave a meeting and truly feel lonely. And I'm like, this something doesn't add up. And I would go to different meetings and go to stag meetings, and there's like a rah-rah at certain meetings, and other meetings have different cliques. And I would look from the outside in and kind of go, I just don't understand. So I would take a service position. I would become a greeter and shake people's hands. And just, I could not make sense of why am I feeling so distant? So I join another fellowship and I go to meetings. And I'm like, join another fellowship, a different meeting. Like maybe it's sex. Okay. Maybe if I can handle that or can solve that, I'll feel the thing that I'm looking to feel. Maybe if I can look at money, maybe. But in the last year, I got to be introduced to two-way prayer by a fellow that I met. And I liked what he shared. And I went through Back to Basics really quickly. And the Back to Basics introduced me to two-way prayer. So I started doing two-way prayer. And I listen. I do my meditation. And then I'm sitting there with a pen and paper. And ideas like, go do this. Okay, I'll go do this. And that led me to take on a service position at a particular meeting. And I do two-way prayer, feeling disconnected from my meetings. Then Kirk shares about this particular meeting. I'm like, okay, I listen, go attend that meeting that he invited you. I come to this meeting. And that's the reason I'm sharing this, and hopefully I'll be able to convey that in just a few minutes. Something is happening inside me that has had me weep, like not chills, not little cry, weep. Many mornings in the last 2, 3 months, specifically in the last two, 3 weeks. But I once shared in this meeting, and doing two-way prayer, I started reading about the Oxford Group, and I have dozens of books on my table reading about the Oxford Group. These men were onto something. And then I started making the connections. Oh, Alcoholics Anonymous is the byproduct of the Oxford Group. And I share this meeting. If the Oxford Group existed today, I would go attend it and give my life to it. And someone reaches out to me and goes, hey, I know a meeting you can go to. You would feel like you're sitting at an Oxford group. I'm like, please send it to me. I start attending it. It's the South Dixie meeting. People are talking about the Lord. People are talking about Christ. Is different scripture, not what my parents would approve of. And I start wa watching the show The Chosen, and I'm weeping, weeping, weeping. And tell this to people around me. They're Jewish. Like, this is the, like, what this preacher, this rabbi is experiencing in the first century is kind of like, it's antithetical to everything that he was raised with. It's antithetical to everything I was raised with. So I go to these meetings, and they're like 3-hour meetings that is an offshoot of South Dixie. And they're reading scripture, and they're reading Bill Wilson, and they're reading scripture, and they're reading Dr. Bob. And they're reading the scripture that Dr. Bob was reading at the first meeting of AA, talking about the actual big book rather than this big book. They were talking about a big book before the big book was reading. So what were they referring to? I don't really know where this is going to lead to, although in the last month, I'm on my knees every morning, a few times through the day and every night, and I'm inviting this power that's been whispering in my ears all these years, quite literally, not figuratively, not because someone read it, but this power has entered in my life and has been knocking the door that I've been busy with worldly clamors. So I don't really know where this leads, but the reason why I said yes to come speak here was because this is a piece in the chain of the little crumbs of guiding me back home. So there's a name, Jamie Winship. Hopefully you look him up. Jamie Winship is one of those pastors that I've listened to daily. And I listen, and I'd be walking around, and he's talking about Christ and talking about a miracle in his life, and I'll just be weeping. Yesterday I'm sitting at a cafe, and I'm now reevaluating who I'm spending time with. And I'm like, oh, of course I didn't feel this power at meetings that I was going to, because people weren't talking about this power. They were talking about a god of their understanding. And the god of their understanding is likely another idol that they are referring to. Like, do I want to build a relationship with the god of my understanding? I want to build a relationship with my creator. I want to build a relationship with the god who's been calling me home for all these years. So I don't really know where this leads, but what is currently happening is a completely new experience for me. I'm seeing Alcoholics Anonymous in a whole new light. And I'm connecting with men who are talking about this relationship that they have with this power. And it's humbling. And I'm going to keep attending to it. And it's interesting, as we were reading, and I'll wrap up with this, we were reading How It Works. And half measures avails us nothing. It's for the first time in my life where I'm willing to give all up. It's the first time I'm willing to say, take my money, take all these flirtatious relationships that I have, all this conniving, manipulative relationships that I'm maintaining. And over the last few weeks, I've messaged a bunch of people and basically told them, you're not going to see me show up the way I have. So I'm not going to be flirting with you anymore. I'm attending Bible classes, and I'm going to see where what God has in store for me. But this relationship between God of the Bible and Alcoholics Anonymous is unfolding in my life, and I owe that God everything that I currently have. And I so wish that I was able to get to hear more from you, but I won't. Hopefully at another meeting. Hopefully I will get to hear more from you.